From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times chief film critic A.O. Scott got in quite a tussle with actor Samuel L. Jackson a couple years back over The Avengers. Jackson didn't like Scott's tough review. Twitter hostility ensued. But A.O. Scott says, look, we need thoughtful, demanding critics. Even when everybody can be a critic on Yelp or Rotten Tomatoes, this hour on Point, A.O. Scott on the role of the critic when everybody's a critic. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see the role of the professional critic when everyone's sharing their two cents online these days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear a critic on last night's Super Bowl halftime show with Coldplay, Beyonce, Bruno Mars. But first, to professional critics right across the board, The Avengers has a starring role in A.O. Scott, Tony Scott's new book on criticism. So let's just be reminded. Here's a bit of the trailer from that 2012 movie, The Avengers, starring Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, Tom Hiddleston as Loki, Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man.
You threatened my world with war. You might not be glad that you did.
What have I to fear?
Let's do a head count.
A couple of master assassins. The demigod. A super soldier. And you've managed to piss off every single one of us.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
From The Avengers. The battle was just getting started there. Joining me now from New York is A.O. Scott, chief film critic at The New York Times, author of the new book, out tomorrow, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. A.O., Tony, Scott, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
So nice to be with you, Tom.
We've talked so many times about movies, and now you're talking about criticism itself. And let's just start, as you do in the book, with this, dust-up with Samuel L. Jackson about the movie. You went, you saw it, you did what you always do, you wrote what you thought. He wasn't happy, and a kind of fundamental, long-running, disagreement over what criticism is or ought to be ensued.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I guess, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say I threatened his world, but I did piss him off. As I think I and my colleagues over the years have angered a good many artists and actors and filmmakers. And
now he's in a Twitter battle with Donald Trump in recent weeks. So you're in some kind of wild company there.
I'm going to stay out of that one. I don't play golf.
All right.
Play politics.
But he thought you missed the point of the movie, and you thought he missed the point of what a critic's supposed to do.
In a nutshell, yes. I mean, he sent out a tweet saying, you know, Avengers fans, we need to find A.O. Scott a new job, one he can actually do. And that got me thinking. That actually did inspire some of this book, because it got me thinking, well, what is this job? How do you actually do it? It's a strange thing on the face of it to be involved in. You know, people go to the movies. They have a good time or not. Why do they need somebody finding fault with it or nitpicking it or analyzing it or overthinking it? And Jackson later came back and kind of accused me in an interview he did with the Huffington Post of intellectualizing this piece of popular culture, which I thought was a very interesting choice of words. He sort of said I was making too much of it, thinking too hard about it, but also kind of not getting it and not getting what a brilliant and wonderful thing it was. And for me, intellectualize, I think, is just a synonym for think. And it's the job of the critic, but I think not only of the professional critic, to take to look at works of art, popular and otherwise, including these gigantic pop culture spectacles that the Hollywood studios push at us every summer, and give them some thought and reflect on them and think, well, what do they mean? What are they doing? What kind of stories are they telling? What kind of value do they have? So for me, criticism is just that, is that thought process, is the scrutiny that we give to the things that are demanding that we pay attention to them.
And here the movie star is essentially responding, saying, hey, just shut up and take what we give you. Just lay back and enjoy the weather or whatever it may be.
Yes. And And fans will say that too. We'll say, hey, come on. I just want to have a good time. I just want to eat some popcorn. And the fact is, I'm not any different from anybody else. I like to have a good time. For me, part of the good time that I have does involve thinking and a sort of engaged reflection on what I see. I think that's true of a lot of people too. And what I'm arguing for partly in this book is for us to be more active, for us to think of ourselves less as passive consumers of whatever it is, whatever entertainment or art we're looking at, but as more actively engaged and interested in it and in a way caring more about it and more about our experiences of it. So in a way, I was not, I think, trivializing the Avengers at all. A movie that had, I thought, and I said in the review, some very admirable and very good qualities. But I wanted to think about how we might take it seriously, because it does seem like if a company, say, has spent $200 million to make something and another $100 million or so to market it to people, there's something serious going on. That's not that can't be completely trivial, can it?
Well, I don't know. A couple of hundred million here and a couple hundred million there these days. Maybe it could. But here you are. I think it's fair to say you're one of the country's most respected critics. And I wonder how you understand when you go out to watch, review, and then think and review, what is it that you're standing up for? Is it some beau ideal of how everything should be? You're the tribunal or the champion of what?
Well, this was the other part of the book was to get at exactly that question. You know, how does it work? You could say, well, my job is as a critic is to articulate and defend standards of excellence in an art form, in this case, movies, and to look at them and judge them and say, well, this is, you know, This falls short, or this rises above these standards. This is wonderful. This is terrible. This is mediocre. Mm-hmm. This is dishonest. This is worthwhile. And the question then becomes: What do you base that on? Where does that impulse and, in a way, that authority come from? And this was the most difficult part of the book to think about, because in some ways, you know, you can't get past the fact that I'm just a person. Like, I didn't go to critic school. I don't have a critic license. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, ordained as a critic by a seminary somewhere. I'm just really a guy who goes to a lot of movies, and there are a lot of other people out there who go to a lot of movies too. So the question is, well, why should anyone listen to me? Where does my judgment come from? What kind of influence or persuasiveness does it have? And I guess where it comes from is my commitment to thinking about and to articulating what those standards are, and for making my judgment something more than just a subjective response. That is, there always is a subjective response. There's always me going to the movies and liking it or not. But it's not very useful to any individual viewer or to the larger cultural conversation for me just to come in with that, to say, well, yeah, I like that. Yeah, that was okay. That was kind of boring. I need to make a case. I need to say, well, here's why I think this was good. Here's why I think this is worthwhile. Here's why I think this might last. And to do that, as much as I can, in a way, without prejudice. Like, I don't feel like I have a list of aesthetic qualities that I'm checking off as I'm watching a movie, saying, well, it moved too quickly, it moved too slowly, they used the wrong filter on this lens or whatever. All of that might play into it, but I want to start out being open to what I'm going to see and open to experiencing it in an immediate way, and then to kind of come back and reflect on that experience and try to say something that is useful to other people who are also interested in that experience.
That all sounds useful. That all sounds even noble. But you yourself remind us that there is this sort of stereotype indictment of the critic as a scold, a snob, a paid hack, your words, intent on punishing artists and spoiling the fun of the public. Why that stereotype?
Well, that was fascinating to me because I started to research this book, I found that you know, you could go all the way back into ancient times and find these stereotypes, and you could certainly find them in movies and on TV, and
you're back with Aeschylus and Plato and, yes, and everybody.
Exactly, exactly. That there's always someone, you know, who's spoiling the fun, or and there's a whole lot of mythology that critics are jealous because we're failed artists, or that we just are averse to pleasure, and that doesn't really correspond with my sense of who I am or what I'm doing. But it was fascinating to me that this kind of symbolic figure, this caricature, this allegory of the terrible critic should exist. And I think it's partly because it's a reflection of our discomfort with judgment. With, you know, in a way, we all want to be, I think, especially now, nice people. We want to be affirmative. We want to we're a little bit afraid of disagreement or of strong opinion. So if we can create these monsters who do that, who we locate this function that's in all of us, and we kind of put it, we find scapegoats for it in a way. And I think that critics sometimes do that. You know, that the there's something that we don't quite trust about our, the way we exercise our judgments, the fact that we do it, the fact that we have strong feelings and opinions about these things. It's you know, we you go to a play or a movie or watch television and we hate it, we love it, and we might be a little embarrassed by those strong feelings.
I don't know. Maybe we want to be nice. I want critics out there with tough, rich opinions and views. There's so much, and we have to sort through it. Of course, Hollywood just wants us to take it. But is it worth taking? This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with New York Times chief film critic A.O. Scott about the role of the critic in our culture, from the pages of the Times to your latest Yelp review. Maybe thinking about art and beauty, pleasure, truth. Maybe pizza, if you're going to Yelp. Tony Scott, A.O. Scott, is out with a big new book, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us, where do you go, for good criticism, for good critics. What do the best critics do for you beyond thumbs up and thumbs down? How do you see the job of the critic in the age of Yelp and Rotten Tomatoes and all the rest? Maybe a little taste of it all the way back in 2003, Mona Lisa Smile, the movie with Julia Roberts, plays a young art professor at Wellesley College in the 50s, and here's that scene where she introduces her students to a new syllabus. What is art? What makes it good or bad, and who decides? Shows them the 1925 painting Carcass by Soutine. Betty, played by Kirsten Dunst, and Connie, played by Jennifer Goodwin, respond.
Is it any good? Come on, ladies. There's no wrong answer. There's also no textbook telling you what to think. It's not that easy, is it?
All right, no. It's not good. In fact, I wouldn't even call it art. It's grotesque.
Is there a rule against art being grotesque?
Is there any rule? Is it good? Is it not good? How do you ask? How do you think about it? How do you know? Emphasis on think there. Tony Scott, A.O. Scott says, let's think. Jim in Fremont, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air with Tony Scott.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I use an app called Flixster for my main source of movie criticism.
Okay.
And if the user and critic scores are less than 50%, I tend to not go to the movie.
And this is kind of like Rotten Tomatoes. Is this regular viewers pitching in their view, Jim? So it's a like the People's Choice thing?
Well, it's regular viewers, but it's also critics. So okay. I tend to look at it more as a kind of a collective criticism, so I take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But am I selling myself short? Because if it's, you know, there may be a really good movie out there that's only got a 25% score, but I tend to really think of the collective criticism nature of Flixster, and I take it seriously.
Let's put it to the man. Tony Scott, how about it? I mean, when you look at the Oscars, you're not kind about how they put things up and vote on things. So what about Flixster and other online review aggregators?
Well, I mean, the aggregation is a very interesting thing, and it's a kind of an it's not entirely new to the internet. I mean, if you think about the Zagat restaurant guides for many years practiced a kind of aggregation based on polling, and I think that these apps and websites like Flixster and Yelp and Metacritic and CinemaScore, there are a lot. You know, they're like opinion research, you know. So they are interesting in that way. They're like political polls, and they can tell you what a lot of other people thought, and that can be useful to the extent that you may be like a lot of other people. I think just as a sort of a consumer guide, they can work pretty well, you know, and when I'm looking, you know, for a restaurant to eat at in a town I haven't been to, I will go on TripAdvisor, I'll go on Yelp and just see, okay, you know, that's mostly 4 stars. That's probably okay. So, you know, I'd be a hypocrite if I said you must avoid these and only consult the works of credentialed critics. What I would say, though, is that there's another dimension of criticism that goes a little farther than that. Whether it's practiced by professional critics or not, which is the thinking part and the conversation part and the argument part, and mm-hmm. and what I think people who like to read criticism get from it is not just kind of advice or opinion or a kind of a finger in the wind about what's being thought about these things, but something interesting to reflect on about it. A lot of people tell me that they read my reviews, and I certainly read a lot of my colleagues and friends' reviews after the fact, after they've gone to the movie. And
sure.
Think, oh, you know, I don't know.
There's kind of pleasure in that.
Yeah.
What do they think? Let's compare, maybe deepen.
Yeah, and it is very much I think a conversation that you're having, that I'm having with my readers, and that I'm also as a reader having with critics. And I don't think that the aggregation numbers or the algorithms out there in the digital world can provide that, which is not to say that it's useless. But there may be some time, as the caller suggests, when there's a movie that he will really love that will really turn out to be great, that's only sitting there with a 20% score on that app, and it might be interesting to go and read the critics who are out of line with everybody else and see what they have to say, and you might, you know, you might find something off the beaten track that way.
Let's plunge a little deeper here with our marvelous audience. Lots of response online. Let me just share. This is a little long, but let me just share. This is MJ writing into us as she listens to you today, or he. I don't know. James Joyce, our listener, writes. Said that art resides between didacticism and pornography. That is, art neither draws one in nor repels one. Art is arresting. One stands before art and says, I am that. Thus, art that taps into the common human identity reminds us of what it means to be human, as well as point to what inhuman is. There's more, but our listener goes on to say the role of the... It is. It's all quite beautiful. It's at the website. Anybody can check it out. Goes on to say the role of the critic is to bring a definition of art to the fray, legitimize the definition, and judge art according to its criteria. Tony Scott, do you agree?
Well, I really wish I had thought of it that way. MJ is very eloquent, and I think onto something. I mean that art has this power, a unique power. It's not like anything else. That experience of being transfixed, of being fascinated, of seeing some image of ourselves in these works that are our own creations in a way is a fascinating and mysterious experience, and it's not like anything else. It doesn't, you know, in the book, I spend some time thinking about the other things that it's sometimes assimilated to, you know, goodness or virtue or sexual desire or all these things. But it's its own. Our experience of art is its own powerful and unique thing, and I think that the job of the critic is precisely to say to find it and to identify it and explain why we need to look at it this way, and this is something that is much as Julia Roberts was saying in that clip, it's difficult. It's hard. That is, we can, you know, there are shortcuts. We can say, well, if it's a, you know, if it's in a museum, if it's hanging on the wall of the Met, then it must be art. If these professors and critics and authorities in the past said it was great art, well, then it must be great art. We must love it. But it's actually a lot harder and more complicated and more slippery than that, because there are great works of art that we now appreciate as such that were not seen that way when they first came into being, that were dismissed as trash or low culture or trivial or not serious, or that got terrible reviews from the critics of their time, that now come to our attention having all of this wonderful value and meaning and this quality that we appreciate. And it's the work of criticism and of critics, of professional critics, but also of all of us as critics, to figure out what those terms are, how those things become art, how we should value them and appreciate them and spread the news about them.
Criticism all over the place these days. You can find plenty. We're going to hear in just a moment from someone who does it full time with Yelp. But lots of callers for you. A.O. Scott, Christine in Dayton, Ohio. You're on the air with Tony Scott. Thanks for calling, Christine.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tony. I'm calling both as a professional actor and as an adjunct faculty member in the theater arts department at Wright State University. And I just wanted to mention that those of us who do theater professionally, we know in our heads that a critic is one person, one person's opinion. Yes, they get to publish that opinion, but it shouldn't change your performance. But I do know in our hearts in the dressing rooms, we talk a lot about critics and what they have said, and we do really take it to heart. So it's a funny dichotomy there. Also in the classroom, I send 16 students out twice a semester to see a professional show and then critique it. They're sort of off on their own to go make their own opinion. And we use a guide for ourselves, and we say, what was this show trying to accomplish? Did it succeed? And was it worth it? So that's where we base our opinions from.
Christine, I love it. Tony.
I think those are very good rules of thumb. I mean, because I think it's important, you know, to judge things as what they are and in terms of what they're trying to do. You know, so if you're going to see if you're going to see a movie like Ride Along 2 to review it, you're not going to say, well, you know, it wasn't Citizen Kane, or it wasn't Do the Right Thing, or it was you have to judge things in their terms, and as they succeed or fail in their own terms. On the other part about actors and other artists reading criticism, it is
or ignoring it or trying
or,
to
or ignoring it, and there are some who say, you know, and why not believe them that they never read it. Others who you hear about, you hear from sometimes. And I mean, I find myself now in a position, having just published a book, of being on the other side of it, of having the reviewers.
Let's just think about Tony's book for a minute here, critically.
Right. And anticipating a few hard knocks from my colleagues. But I think it's also true that criticism works, and I have a chapter about this in the book, about how criticism works within the arts themselves. You know, that is, if you're a teacher and you're teaching people how to act, or how to paint, you're also criticizing and critiquing them. Also, if you're an artist, you're in a critical relation to other works of art. You study other performances, let's say, if you're an actor. You start out wanting to make films because of the films that you've seen, and you want to make movies just like those movies, or a little bit different, or correct them, or do something different. So I think that creative people are by their nature, and by the nature of the arts that they practice, doing a kind of criticism. So you can't avoid it, right? It's everywhere.
Christine, and your students trying not to read or pay attention, but also paying attention. There's the conundrum. Nobody can get away from it. Everybody's a critic these days. Sam writes to us online, I'm just mad this dude gets paid and I don't. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Sorry, I'm laughing.
Yeah,
that's
all right.
Pretty good. Well, I think the one thing I was thinking about in all of this, my background's history and social policy, and critical thinking is just absolutely vital to deal with problems as well as looking through the aesthetic of art, because art certainly comes into it. And it seems to me, and it isn't that you want to, I don't want to feel like a gatekeeper, for example, but I remember being in a conference thing with a fellow who said, oh, well, all opinion matters. It's all equal. It's you know, it's good for all the time, more democracy, more this, more that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, you've got to have critical thinking skills. You can't just mouth off or you're going to have total chaos. And how are you going to determine what really, as Mr. Scott points out, what's of quality? What really matters in the end? And, of course, then re-examining something, as he pointed out, where you have an art that was not appreciated so thoroughly in its time, and then finally, after a while, I think of one film, for example, that was on a second billing in the 50s, Night of the Hunter, which has astounded me to this day. And it was dismissed then, and now it's seen as an American classic.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah. It definitely happens. How do you, Peter, thank you so much. Tony Scott, you quote Immanuel Kant, no less, Critique of Judgment, saying, Kant saying, the judgment of taste cannot be other than subjective. So if that's the case, if Kant is right, what does really of quality mean?
Well, that, I mean, Kant is using that to as the sort of as the starting point, as the kind of the given, mm-hmm. to try to drag judgment up the ladder toward something, toward reason, you know, mm-hmm. that it's not just kind of reflexive or instinctive, but is something that can be engaged with the rational side of our minds and our abilities and our public discourse. And I think that Peter raises really the very interesting paradox, which is that we want to be democratic. We want to say that every opinion counts, and we believe that, but we also want there to be more to it than that. That is, it's just, you know, a kind of a state of anarchy in a way, just to say, well, everybody, you know, what you think is fine, what I think is fine, we all do our mm-hmm. own thing, we all like what we like. In a way, that's true, but it also doesn't solve the problem of figuring out in some collective or collaborative way what matters, what's worth keeping, what's worth looking at, what do we care about, not just individually and not just temporarily, but in a more permanent way and as a society or even as a species. And it's that critical thinking and that kind of discussion that is the work of criticism that I think is very important and that is unending and often very frustrating, but is very important. That is, we have to in a way start out with our own subjective judgments and experiences and responses and feelings, but then we have to figure out how to talk about those, how to reason about that, and that I think is kind of what the role of criticism or critical thinking, as Peter calls it, in society. And again, it's to go back to Julia Roberts, it's hard work. We don't always know how to explain our own thoughts and our own judgments, or how to listen to other people's.
Tony Scott, A.O. Scott, the new book is Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. He is chief film critic for the New York Times. When we come back, we're going to put him in the ring with a elite Yelp reviewer and see what we learned there. Behind me here, Amy Black, the owner of The Supper Truck. It's a food truck in Albuquerque, New Mexico, wrote a song to respond to a Yelp reviewer who gave her a one-star review. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We're sorry we let you down. We hate to see you frown. So don't let us drown in our tears, because you wrote us a one-star review. Vero, can't you see how chicken bun and me on me. We've tried to reconcile. We'll go the extra mile because we love you in spite of your one star review.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times chief film critic A.O. Scott, Tony Scott. He's been thinking about criticism itself, professional criticism above all. He's out with a new book exploring his understanding of what it's all about. It is Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. Emphasis, I'd say, having read this, on thinking. Let's think about what we are offered and see how it stacks up in that way. Before this hour is out, we will hear a critic on last night's halftime show at the Super Bowl. While we're in the critiquing mode, we'll go right to Beyonce and Bruno Mars and Coldplay and all the rest. Tony Scott joins us from New York, and it's so great to have him with us. Response online, there's all kinds of... David says, A.O. is irrelevant. What is relevant? Discussions with artists and audiences, not judgment from people without artistic talent. Tony Scott takes that.
Ouch.
Ouch. Ouch. I mean, you call criticism actually a twin, almost an art, yes, in itself, or a twin of art. Hold that thought. On the other hand, here's Steve, and he says, here in France, there's a weekly radio show on France Inter where critics discuss films live on air and often argue strongly. I find this form of critique refreshing and lacking in this in the general media, maybe here. Tony Scott, I want to put you face-to-face with a different kind of critic. Cassie Glenn joins us right now. You're in New York. She's in Miami. She's Miami Community Manager at Yelp. She's written over 800 reviews on Yelp. She's a member of Yelp's elite squad. Cassie Glenn, of Yelp in Miami. Thank you for joining us. You're on the air with Tony Scott. Thanks a lot for being here, Cassie.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So how do you think about what you do and what Tony does? I don't know if you read A.O. Scott, but he's maybe the biggest film critic in the country. You've got, criticism of everything at Yelp. Are you in the same business?
You know, I think that critics and reviewers, people definitely see them in a different light, but I think the ultimate goal is the same. Everyone's out there looking for the best places to spend their money, and that can apply to people reading Tony's work to figure out what movie they should go see. You know, movies can be pretty expensive these days, so getting that right ticket that's really going to get their bang for their buck and be enjoyable, or going to Yelp to figure out where they should find the best meal or go to, buy the best dress for a wedding. Exterminator, whatever it may be.
Do you feel the same kind of pushback that Tony Scott gets, where people will say, who the heck are you to judge my meal or my restaurant or my exterminator business?
You know, I mean, business owners go through a lot. When you're a local business owner, obviously it's your heart and soul. So it can hurt when maybe you don't get the most glowing review. But part of my job is to work very closely with business owners and help them use, tools that we have available to them, whether it's public commenting on a review or private messaging, and just kind of opening up that dialogue. That's one point Tony made in one of his articles. Now everything's online, so you're really able to engage with these people that are, critiquing your restaurant or business. And, if anything, it's a great learning experience. I've talked to business owners that there was a guy who owns a burger shop, and everyone kept saying the burgers were super salty. So he went into his business, tasted a burger, and realized, oh, yeah, this is pretty salty, and changed, the recipe. And so just taking those criticisms to heart and just seeing, maybe what you can improve to improve your overall star rating, I think that's one of the special things about all these different channels, whether it's Rotten Tomatoes and Yelp, that are out there right now.
Tony, big movies and burger shops and exterminators and an army of citizen critics now out there that has emerged since you got into the business of being a critic. What have you thought to yourself as you've seen Yelp and all of its cousins rise up here? I mean, the headline on your essay a week or two ago was, everybody's a critic, and that's how it should be. Do you welcome this era of mass internet criticism?
I do, and I've come, I mean, I not without some mixed feelings, but I have to say that more voices, and especially more independent voices, and more argument, and more kind of more democracy is never a bad thing. And I think that criticism has always been chaotic in a way. One thing I went back and did some research in the book and found that a lot of the things that people have been freaking out about the internet, you know, about professional critics maybe have been, especially about how, you know, it's everybody just it's chaotic, it's anarchy, it's everybody screaming and yelling at once, and all of these opinions have been said about criticism since the beginning of print. It's always unruly, it's always chaotic, it's always people who have no right to talking, and I include myself in that. You know, who am I?
Yes, but you say bring it on.
I do have a job. I say bring it on, and also let people sort it out. I think you have to trust that you have to trust human intelligence, trust human thinking. I mean, yes, of course, there are always abusives. There are people who are going to go on Yelp and write, you know, really mean, unfair things because they're in a bad mood that day, because they had a bad date or a
something
fight with
a
their
professional
girlfriend
critic
or whatever.
Would surely never do.
And they're just going to take it out on that poor restaurant or exterminating business. And there are, you know, there are certainly critics like me, you know, who have written things that seem, you know, mean-spirited or harsh or just bizarre. But in the end, you know, I think that that's all very, very healthy and very good, and that you know, sorting it out and kind of separating the sound judgment from the less sound judgment is the work that we're all doing as critics. So I don't. When Yelp and other kind of user generated reviewing sites started popping up, I was a little horrified. But then I found myself, you know, yeah, when I have bugs in my house and I need someone to come and kill them, I need to find out who I can trust to do that.
So Kessie, do you talk with your contributors about how to up the quality of their reviews, one way or another?
Definitely. Yeah, so you mentioned the Elite Squad. And so what that is, those are our most active users on the sites. They're the role models out there writing the most useful, funny, and cool reviews. And how they get that elite designation is through a nomination process. And we kind of we host special events for them. So people will see us having these really cool events at local businesses and want to get involved. So, you know, they ask me, how do I become elite? And while it's an elite council at HQ that really designates it, I can at least coach them. So I do provide some tips because ultimately, you know, we really want juicy, quality, useful content on the site. So that's always what we're striving for. And that's kind of what people want when they come to Yelp. So whenever you see that elite reviewer up there, ideally, you know, that's going to be a really useful piece of content that you can trust going into it.
You don't pay them though, do you?
No. It's all voluntary.
The horror.
You know,
the horror.
Yeah. No,
that's another argument.
Yeah. Yeah. Stairway to Heaven there on Yelp. Kessie Glenn, community manager in Miami for Yelp. Thanks so much for being with us, Kessie.
Thanks for having me.
Tony, we've just got one more minute with you before we get into critiquing the halftime show at Super Bowl. What do you hope people take away from what you're sharing with the view of the high tier critic here?
That criticism is something that that we all do, that we all should do as well as we can, that it is the name for our engagement with our world and the ways that we make meaning in that world, and that it's in a way too important to be left to professionals like me.
We'll take it right there. With a little Immanuel Kant and Aeschylus and Plato thrown in on the side, a little Rilke. It's all there in Tony Scott's new book. It is Better Living Through Criticism. how to think about art, pleasure, beauty, and truth, no less. A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, we're headed to the Super Bowl. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Listeners, in a moment, a review of last night's Super Bowl 50 halftime show. This is On Point. Okay, the Super Bowl is about football, and congratulations to Peyton Manning and the Denver Broncos for their big win last night. But of course, it's also about the ads and the halftime show. Last night, that was Coldplay, Bruno Mars, and Beyoncé in big performances. What did the critics say? Let's ask one. Dee Lockett is with me from New York, associate editor at Vulture, New York Magazine's entertainment news site. Dee Lockett, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So here we are, Levi's Stadium, San Francisco, and a big Super Bowl in that it's number 50, reviewing in the middle of it film, video from many, many years of halftime shows there. How did you think last night stacked up, Dee?
I thought it was pretty great, actually. You know, the theme of this year's Super Bowl was obviously celebrating the 50th anniversary, and the halftime show reflected that as well. There was a brief montage in the middle of it where you saw clips from previous performances throughout the years. And obviously, the performance itself incorporated that. You know, Beyoncé wore an outfit that was similar to the same one that Michael Jackson wore when he performed the Super Bowl in 1993. It was a similar black and gold outfit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first thing I heard about last night was it was going to be Coldplay. But without Bruno Mars and Beyoncé, it would have been pretty tame stuff out there.
For sure. And I think that Coldplay performed well, as they always do. However, their live performance is more tailored to a nighttime show. I think you could see that with a lot of their lighting displays, which didn't necessarily play that well in the daylight. But the Super Bowl knew what it was doing, and they kept their performance to the bare minimum, and they also allowed Beyoncé and Bruno Mars to step in and do their thing, as they have both done at previous shows.
Okay, let's go to Bruno Mars. I mean, this guy's a very smooth performer with his sort of, I don't know, leather mouse suit or whatever that was last night. Pretty cool.
And a Jerry curl.
Yeah. What did you think of what he brought to the show?
You know, I thought it was well done. He surprisingly has not performed Uptown Funk that often, so it was nice to see him and Mark Ronson also DJing on the stage.
Yeah.
And just having a fun little dance battle that, you know, sort of segued into Beyoncé.
Mark Ronson was with us on this show just a couple of weeks ago. We're still waiting for Beyoncé and Bruno. And then there's Beyoncé, and I don't know if there's any precedent for what she did. That is, introducing a brand new song at the Super Bowl halftime. Is that chutzpah or brilliant or just something only Beyoncé can do? What about it?
It is absolutely something only Beyoncé could do, and it's just a testament to her brilliant marketing. She understands how to be a pop star like no other pop star her age and of her generation.
The new tune is Formation. It had only been released to the public, I don't know, a day or hours before the actual halftime event. Tell us about this song and her presentation of it last night. What was going on there?
Well, the song and the video were released at the same time, late on Saturday, mid-afternoon on Saturday, and obviously performed the next day. So this is the first time everyone is hearing it live. It might be even the first time some people are hearing it, period, who didn't hear it when it was released. And it's a very political song. It's a very pro-black song. And she evoked that spirit in both the video and the performance by having her backup dancers dress as Black Panthers.
So that's what the sort of iconography was all about, was referencing all the way back to the Black Panthers in the 1960s, but as you say, very political as well, tapping into all the Black Lives Matter energy of the last couple of years.
Oh, yes, for sure. And I can't recall anyone else getting to say the word Negro during the Super Bowl.
I can't recall the last time I heard the word Negro in a popular song, period.
No, of course not. I mean, it's such a controversial word, and the whole song is about reclaiming the term as a pro-black term that black people can use to celebrate black pride.
I mean, she can own it if anybody can. I remember it was a couple of years ago where she came out on stage up against the giant letter spelling out feminist behind her. And the next, the lyrics, can you give us more of what she was saying? It's kind of hard to make out individual lyrics in a giant arena.
I mean, a huge part of the song is talking about slaying, which is a very popular gay term that has also become a more mainstream term for just becoming a successful, powerful black woman. And the whole huge part of the song is, I slay, yes, I slay. And there's also a huge part of the song where she talks about becoming a black Bill Gates in the making. And that's just a powerful statement in and of itself. And just, it's a very, very pro-black song. There's a section in the performance where her and her dancers actually give the Black Power salute, which is very historical.
Slaying, like nailing it or killing it.
Yes.
I guess in that enormous stadium last night, not many people would have been following along the lyrics very closely, but maybe that's not what makes a successful Super Bowl performance. What is it? Is it what the people in the bowl feel, what the people on television feel? What makes a barn burner of a Super Bowl halftime?
I think it's the audience reaction at home more so than in the stadium. I mean, no one really knows what it looks like in the stadium unless you've been to a Super Bowl, which I have not. And I think that what makes a great Super Bowl performance is the immediate reaction on social media afterwards. If social media says you did a good job, then you did a good job. If not, then you're going to be remembered for not having done a good job.
A million critics at the ready. I'm pretty sure there was one nanosecond there where she almost fell on her hind end, but she managed to catch it in those heels and all the rest. Pretty good move.
But Beyonce being Beyonce, even her almost falling is a non-event to her. I mean, you wouldn't even have known. And I suspect that had she fallen, you still wouldn't have known because she would have made it into a dance move. Like, you wouldn't even have noticed.
A backward flip or something, and off we'd go.
Yes.
D. Lockett with Vulture in New York, associate editor there. Great of you to join us for a couple of minutes today. Thank you so much, D.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great
day. You too. We go out with Beyonce from last night's Super Bowl halftime show, debuting her new single, Formation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.